Okay, let me just mute everyone.
Over.
Okay, this is the Yecheskel Shir, Le'ilu Nishmos Ephraim Shmuel ben Avram Arya Cohen and Chai Tova Bas Eliezer Mendel HaKohen on the book of Yecheskel. Again, this Shir is also dedicated to all our soldiers. And we are holding in chapter 16 of Yecheskel, and we're at verse 22. This chapter really is all about an allegory about the relationship between God and the Jewish people through the ages. We're up to the point where God is castigating the Jewish people about how far they fell subsequent to their arrival in the land of Israel and their attaining supremacy and monarchy and control really over the area of influence they had in the Middle East. And all of a sudden, their dedication to God started to dwindle. And now God really starts to sum it up. This is in verse 22. Again, this is just a recap of really of Jewish history. So up to the time of Yechezkel. So he says in verse 22, Ve'etz kol tovo saich, betaznu saich, lo zochart, et yimeinu raich. With all the abominable behavior and all the perverted activities you got yourselves involved in, you did not remember the days of your youth. Biyoseich erom ve'eriyah, when I found you, when you were naked and bare, mistoveves, misboseses, bedomaich hois, when you were wallowing in your own birth blood. So God reminds the Jewish people really how far they've fallen. Here you've got all the commentators about Ravenel and the Malbim say God is reminding them that about two things that they've forgotten about. Now, when things are good, right, when things are good, so you forget the bad times, and it's all about the good times. So these are the two things that they forgot. They forgot all the kindness that God did for them when they were naked and helpless, lying soaked in their own blood at the mercy of their own oppressors whilst in slavery, whilst enslaved in Egypt. And you've started now to believe your own publicity, that your rise from the dung heap of Egypt to the pinnacle of being a regional superpower was your own doing, or maybe it was just a coincidence. And number two, that you Jews forgot that I'm God, and I can easily put you back into the same position you were hundreds of years ago in Egypt. At this point in time, we're talking about it's well over 600 years since they left Egypt. To about 600, 700, 800 years, 850 years since they left Egypt. And God's saying that you know, I can easily find another nation that will oppress you equally harshly, or even more so than the Egyptians ever did, and revert you to being a state of again being a erom ve'eriyah, naked, bare, without any type of protection. And he continues in verse 23, by he acharei koros roseich. What will be after all your evil? Oi, oi, loch. Woe, woe to you, Ne'um Hashem Elokim, says God. Now, this is a double expression. Oi, oi. So in Judaism, oi is a very important word, right? It's one of the most important words that we ever use. Oi, vei, oi, oi, oi. So what does it mean? The double expression, woe, woe, oi, oi, to you. So Rashi says here, woe to you because of all your sins, number one, and woe to you because you've never repented. There's two things there. And this is really the two complaints that God always has with the Jewish people. Number one, sinning. So sinning's not so terrible, right? Sinning's not so terrible. Everybody sins. We're all created with the Yetzirah. We're all created with free will. And so sinning's not so bad. The Gemara says, Yehudi, afal pi shechotah, sorry, Yisrael, afal pi shechotah, Yisrael, a Jew. Despite the fact that he sins, he's still Jewish. So, you know, that's just a fact of life. But even worse is that you recognize that you've done a sin and you're not prepared to do teshuva. That's what God can't abide. So that's a double expression here, according to Rashi. The Malvern's got a different approach. The Malvern says the expression here, oi, oi, loch, woe, woe is to you, is aimed at a particular, in particular, at a particular king, from the past. It's King Ahaz, who the Malvern mentioned earlier. We've discussed him in previous shirim, who was the first king of Yehuda to encourage open public paganism in the land of Israel. Up until the time of Ahaz, which we discussed before, Jews were getting themselves involved in paganism, idolatrous activity, but it was all behind closed doors. When Ahaz came to the throne, he instituted public idol worship. In Ahaz's time, the kingdom of Yehuda, remember, he's the son of a great tzaddik, Ahaz, and he's the father of a great tzaddik. One of the strange things about the kings of Yehuda is, generally speaking, you had a righteous king followed by a wicked one, and vice versa. You had a wicked one followed by a righteous one. So he's the righteous one. He's the wicked one in the middle of two righteous kings. His father was Yotam, who was one of the greatest kings in Jewish history. And his son was Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Hezekiah. Again, if you had to make a list of the five greatest kings in Jewish history, so Ahaz's father and his son would both be on the list, Yotam and Chizkiyahu. But he was a rotten, no good, low-life. And during his reign, as is pointed out by the Malbim here, the kingdom of Yehuda came under increasing pressure from the Assyrian Empire. The Assyrian Empire was the empire that was on the rise at that particular time. We're talking about the year about 550 BCE, well before the Babylonians came to town. You had the Assyrian Empire that would eventually take the 10 tribes of the Northern Kingdom into exile. And instead of going to his prophets, Ahaz preferred to try and appease the Assyrians. Now, the method of appeasement has been a popular approach of world leaders for thousands of years. I can tell you, if you read Jewish history and you read world history, appeasing dictators and appeasing evil people never works. It's always taken as a sign of weakness. Just ask Neville Chamberlain. Well, you can't really ask Neville Chamberlain because he's not alive. But Neville Chamberlain would certainly tell you that appeasement with dictators and evil empires just doesn't work. But Ahaz was determined to try and appease the Assyrians, and the more he appeased them, the weaker he appeared to the Assyrian king, who we know, everybody knows, everyone who studied Jewish history knows who that was. It's King Sennacherib. And the more the appeasement, the greater the pressure from the Assyrian Empire on the southern kingdom of Yehuda. So says the Malbim, the two ois in this verse is oi number one, oi loch, oi to you, Ahaz. Firstly, you could easily have escaped the pressure applied to you by the Assyrians if you have just returned to God and done teshuva. In other words, get rid of the idols. You didn't do that. And oi loch, woe to you, Ahaz. Secondly, not only did you not turn to me and do teshuva, but on the contrary, you doubled down on your loyalty to the pagan gods, which is very clear from the Tanakh, as it says in Divrei HaYomim, regarding the reign of King Ahaz, uba'es hatzerlo, at the time that Sennacherib oppressed him, that he oppressed him, that Sennacherib oppressed him, by Yosef Limol Hashem. The more he was oppressed, the more by Yosef Limol Hashem, the more Ahaz persisted to act rebelliously against God. Hu Melech Ahaz. And the pasuk says that if you want to know a description of King Ahaz, that is it. That the more pressure that was applied to him, the more evil he became, the more he relied on his paganism. So going to the Malbim, this is a specific period in Jewish history. It's an important moment in Jewish history because it's a time when the Jewish people took another step downwards, slid down another snake into the abyss, where, God, so to speak, could probably, I don't know, I'm not speaking for, I don't speak for God, but it seems that God was prepared to tolerate paganism in its private form to a certain degree, But when it came to paganism in public in the land of Israel, God, so to speak, drew a red line at that point. And now we hear in verses 24 and 25, the effects of Ahaz's policy of public paganism. Vatibniloch Gav, Vatasiloch Roma Bechol. Firstly, you built towers. You made yourself bomos, which are mounds for offering sacrifices. Bechol rechov, everywhere, on every street. You made idols, you built towers to the Avodah Zorah, temples to the Avodah Zorah. There was a construction plan going on in the land of Israel, orchestrated by Ahaz, so that everywhere you looked down the street, you could see an idol, and that was by design. And in 25, Eskol Rosh Derech, at the head of every crossroads, Bonis Ramoseich, you built pagan shrines, Vatis Avi Esyofiech, and you turned your beauty into an abomination, Vatafaski Es Raglaich Lechol Over, and you spread it. The Navi doesn't spare anything for the imagination. Vatapaski es raglaich l'chol over, and you spread your legs for every passerby. Vatarabi es tezunosayah, and you increased your perverted sexual practices, so that once the Jews started to worship Avodah Zorah, paganism in public during the time of this king Ahaz, that was the thin end of the wedge. As far as God was concerned, and it also signaled a real rapid downhill spiral. Paganism had been brewing slowly under the surface in the land of Israel for many years. But once it came out into the public domain, so to speak, that was the flame that lit the blue touch paper and set the whole world alight. As the Medrash in Eicha, the Medrash in Eicha Rabbah, in the introduction to Eicha, which is the Book of Lamentations that we read on Tisha B'Av, describes, this is in the Psichta, in the introduction to the Medrash on Lamentations, on Eicha. The Medrash says as follows, Rabbi Yudin and Rabbi Avu was, we could have a whole shiur on who Rabbi Avu was, but Rav Yudin, Rav Eivu, and Rav Tavi said in the name of Rav Yoshia, on each and every channel of their fields they would place an idol. So they brought an idol out to work with them. They were all farmers. It was an agrarian society. And they used to bring their idols out into the fields with them so they could have they could dab mincha lahavdil, with the idol during the day while they were at work. It says the Medrash, Rav Pinchas and Rav Chilki said in the name of Rav Oshia, each of them would plow his field on diagonal lines and then place their idol in the center of the diagonals so that all the heads of the channels of the fields would point in the direction of the idol. And the Medrash continues, since no one reprimanded them, they began doing this same thing in the streets. As it says in Yechezkel, quoting our pasuk, verse 24, or the first one of these two psukim, verse 24, Vatibni loch gav, vatasi loch roma b'chol rechov. You built yourself prominent towers, and you made lofty places, mounds, bomos, which are mizbechus, high rise places of worship and offerings for offering mizbech, altars in every street. And since no one reprimanded them for that, they began to do so at all the crossroads in the cities, as it says in verse 25, Al Kol Rosh Derech Benis Ramoseh. In every crossroads, you built pagan shrines. And again, since no one reminded them, they began doing so in the cities as themselves. And this is reported not here by Yechezkel, but this is reported by Yirmiyahu, by Jeremiah, the prophet Jeremiah, right at the beginning in the second chapter. Ki mispa orech hoyu Elohayich Yehuda. For like the number of your cities were your gods, Yehuda. Like they had everything. They worship anything. Wishing two flies crawling up a wall. Yirmiyahu says sarcastically, you had as many gods as you did cities. And the Medrash continues. Again, no one reprimanded them for this. No one said a dicky bird. No one complained. They began doing so in the streets of Yerushalayim. As it says again in Yirmiyahu, and like the number of streets of Jerusalem, in all the streets of Jerusalem, you place shameful altars to burn incense to the pagan Baal. And how far did they go? How far did they spiral down in this degrading fashion? It was to the extent that they introduced Avodah Zorah into the Beis HaMikdash itself during the time of King Ahaz, as it says in Yechezkel. This is something that we've learned previously in chapter 8. If you remember the story of in chapter 8, it says, L'shar ha-mizbeach somol hakino hazer babir. At the gate of the altar was a four-headed idol of fury, which was called the Semel, which eventually King Menasheh, which is Ahaz's grandson, King Menasheh's idol, he was placed like on the steps leading into the Kodesh Kodashim, and it was designed. It was a four-headed idol, if you remember from chapter 8, and it was designed to mock God, to infuriate God, because the whole idea of God's chariot, so to speak, which we discussed in chapter 1 and chapter 10, had four heads to it. If you remember, the four animals, four chayos, four angels with four heads that carried God's chariot. So Menasheh, to make fun, to infuriate God, so he built this idol. It's called the Semel, and it was situated in leading up to the Kodesh Kodashim. That's how far it went. And that's only two generations from Ahaz. Ahaz had a son, Chizkiyahu, who was a great tzaddik. And of course, as I explained to you before, in the course of history, so generally speaking, a great tzaddik would have a rosha, a terrible rosha, wicked man for a son. So Chizkiyahu's son was King Menasheh, who was the worst of all the kings, the worst of all the kings. A murderer, just everything. That's what became of this beautiful woman. That's what became of this beautiful woman that God, the beautiful woman, this beautiful child, this beautiful foundling that became a beautiful woman that God married on Mount Sinai. That's how far she fell. And as the Malbim points out here in these two verses, the verse says, "Vatisavi es yofyech." You turned your beauty into an abomination. That's what God's criticism of them. You could have been so beautiful. You're a beautiful child. You were protected and you were educated by me, and you married me. And look what you've become. You turned your beauty has been turned into abomination. Says the Malbim, "Hayisa kekadesha." You became like a worn out whore. There you see, language, right? Using that language, the Kadesha, the Malbim, right? You know, it became like a worn-out whore. Shemirov ha-niof nis'ayev yofyo ubolu poneho va'a'oz techasa poneho. Listen how he describes it. You became like a worn-out whore who, as a result of so much adultery, became unsightly, hideous. So at first you had to hide this prostitute became such a worn out prostitute that first she had to, and she lost all her beauty. So the first thing she had to do was to hide her face. And then she had to cover, the rest of her body as, all her original beauty waned. And all because, says, the Malbim, Batifsiki Esraglaich Lacholover, you spread your legs for every passerby. Rotzalama, meaning Shekvar Some Alaich, Haderech Elohim, Voyisa Kagoyim Habzuyim Nichnoim Lakol. You had already rejected, turned away from God's path, and you became like the despised, shameful pagan, submitting themselves to every type of pagan activity you could put your hands on. But Gam, The end of the verse, the end of verse 25, Vagam Vatir Biestazunosaich, Lahasmid Ba'avodas Necha. And you enlarged, amplified, multiplied your perverted sexual practices, meaning you kept on looking for new, more exciting pagan worships to involve yourself with. And this is the nature of the addict, right? The nature of the addict is it starts off, you know, you read the literature. If you read the book, there's a great book called The Body Keeps the Score. And in it, it describes the nature of addiction. The nature of addiction, especially chemical addiction, whether it be alcohol, whether it be drugs, whether it be gambling, whether it be sex, it's irrelevant. The common theme to all of it with these types of chemical addiction, whether it's a dopamine addiction, adrenaline addiction, the more you have, the more you've got to have. And so you can start off by smoking a joint when you're at university, but after a short period of time, it's not enough. The high is not enough. And this is how it was with the Jewish people. It started off, you know, we'll go to, you know, see what it's, let's go to their temple and see what their, you know, what Easter's like, what the service at Easter's like. Well, it's Easter Monday today. And you enjoy it, and before you know it, so you enjoy the pagan activities, and you get more involved in it, and then the excitement, you want more excitement, more and more and more and more, until as the Malbim says, nothing was enough. You're forever looking for something new, something more exciting, something different, another foreign pagan thing to worship, to involve yourself in, something more exciting than the last one. And in verse 26, the Navi continues, or God continues, now God discusses all the countries surrounding the Jewish state, all the countries surrounding Israel, Yehuda, and in the north as well, the northern kingdom, but particularly the kingdom of Yehuda, all the countries that surrounded them, and the fact that they got themselves involved with every country that bordered Israel. The Jews wanted to be involved in their culture. The interesting thing is the countries themselves, as we'll discuss, the Egyptians and the Philistines, etc., and the Babylonians, they kept to their own paganism. They were satisfied with their own paganism. The Jews, they're never satisfied. If they're going to go off the rails, they're going to go off the rails properly, right? So they want to get involved with everybody's paganism. So he says, God starts off with his list in verse 26, the list of all the pagan activities the Jews got involved in and the nations that they got involved, had these particular types of pagan activity and pagan worship. So he starts off with Egypt. And there's a reason for starting off with Egypt. Vatizni el b'nei Mitzrayim. You had sexual relations with the sons of Egypt. Shcheinayich, gidlei bosar, your neighbors, your big fat neighbors. Vatirubies taznuseich lahachiseini. And you increase your perverted sexual pagan practices to provoke me, to anger me. Now, God begins this dark list of all the nations to whom the Jews tried to emulate in their pagan practices during this period. And we're talking a period of about 120, 130 years, from about the year 550 BCE right through to the destruction of the first temple in the year 423. So 125, 130 years. In that time, they tried everything out. The list of all the nations begins with Egypt. Egypt was not only Israel's first real nemesis, not forgetting, of course, who can forget the fact that we're coming up to Pesach now. Pesach is the commemoration of our exodus from Egypt, which was our first real taste of slavery, which is our first, they were our first nemesis. But apart from the fact that we were slaves in Egypt for hundreds of years, the Egyptians were a continuing thorn in the side of the Jewish people throughout their biblical history. The whole notion of the Israelites' first national sin, which is the golden calf, was a throwback to their time in Egypt, because the golden calf, the calf was one of the major gods of Egypt. As Yirmiyahu points out, and it's pointed out on multiple occasions in the Tanakh, but Yirmiyahu gets it exactly spot on here. In the 46th chapter, he describes Egypt, Eglah Yefefiah Mitzrayim. Egypt is like a handsome calf. In other words, he's saying that the god of Egypt is a calf, and that's what you want. It's Yefefiah. You viewed it. You Jews viewed their calf as Yefefiah, which comes into modern Hebrew, the language of Yefefiah. You say about, you see something that's beautiful, you say it's Yefefiah. And well, that language comes from Eglah Yefefiah, from the language of Yirmiyahu, describing their God. Their God was the calf. And the Malbin explains here, or the Malbin explains there, Mitzrayim hoyim mechabdim maritzim es hashar shichas omad banov. The Egyptians honored, adored the cow, the bull, the calf, which they considered to be their major deity, and the statue of it always stood in public view. Whichever city you went to in Egypt in the ancient world, there'll always be a statue of a calf to worship in that city. And so the Malbim says, on that basis, we can understand why God mentions here that when they built an idol in the shape of a calf, they did it, as Yechezkel says, lahachiseni. Like when they built the golden calf in the desert, shortly after receiving the Torah, it was, as the verse says here, he doesn't say about any of the other countries that we're going to discuss. He said that we're going to discuss lahachiseni, to provoke me, to anger me. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that it's not mentioned so much in the discussion of the story of the golden calf. But it's an important thing that one of the ideas behind the golden calf was that they got so excited because it's lahachiseni, that they knew it would provoke and anger God. And that's why we can understand the Torah's warning about Egypt in general, which comes in Vayikra in chapter 18. We'll read it in a few weeks. A warning. Kamasa Eretz Mitzrayim asher yeshavtem bo lo sasu. The pagan perverted practices of the land of Egypt in which you lived, you must not do. And the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, in the 13th century, explains what these practices were. Apart from the worship of animals, most notably the cow, the bull, and the calf, the Egyptians were also addicted to carnality, sexual impropriety in all its perverted forms, including homosexuality, incest, and bestiality. But of course, the Jews did not follow the warning, says the Rambam, as God clearly indicated or indicates here. That's why the Egyptian experience, the Egyptian inter or the interaction of the Jewish people in Jewish history with the Egyptians is mentioned first here, because it started first and it never ended. And that's why God says here, "Vatizniel b'nei Mitzrayim shcheinech." You had relations. It doesn't mean literally sexual relations, although that was part of it. But it means you got yourself involved in all their perversions with the Mitzrayim, with Egypt. Shcheinayich gidlei boso, the fat sons of Egypt. V'atirbiyes tiznuseich. And you increased your perverted sexual practices to provoke me, to anger me. And the description of the Egyptians being neighbors of gidlei boso, of great flesh, like the implications is gidlei boso means like someone who's fat, or great flesh. So this, what does it mean exactly that they were gidlei boso? So it's a very strange medrash in Vayikra. The medrash in Vayikra Rabbah explains this pasuk. Our pasuk here, which is verse 26 again, as follows. It says, "Vatizniel b'nei Mitzrayim shcheinayich gidlei boso." You imitated, you had relations, you had interactions, perverted pagan interactions with the sons of Egypt, your neighbors of great flesh. Says the Medrash, what does Gidlei Bosor mean? What does it mean? Of great flesh. Does this mean that some Egyptians had one leg and others had three legs? Obviously not, says the Medrash. Rather, it is that they were all uncircumcised, and the Egyptians' men possessed large male organs. I don't know how the Medrash knew that, but the Egyptian men possessed large male organs, so that the allegory here, says the Medrash, is that just like the adulterous promiscuous women chase after men with large male organs to enhance their illicit sexual experience, similarly, the Jews of Israel chased after the Egyptians' culture that boasted an extensive collection of pagan and perverted sexual practices. So now you get an insight into the mindset of the Jewish people during this 130-year period leading up to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Egyptians. And again, before we go on to the next verses, there's other things we need to say here. It says right at the end of this verse, verse 26, that by Tirubi est you increased your perverted pagan and sexual activities with the Egyptians. So the Medrash asks, what is God referring to here? And the Medrash says, very early on in the United Kingdom of Israel, Egyptian paganism crept into Jewish life. Like even before it was public, under the time of Ahaz, when paganism became public practice and public policy, nevertheless, even earlier than that, Egyptian paganism crept into Jewish life, and specifically into Jerusalem. Now, would it be possible for Egyptian paganism to creep into Jewish life? And if it crept into Jewish life, why would it creep into Jerusalem first? And the answer is, blame it all on the king. This is Malachim, the book of Malachim, the first book of Kings, chapter 3, verse 1. This was a huge mistake by one of the greatest kings in Jewish history, by Yitzchak Shlomo es Paro Melech Mitzrayim. Shlomo allied himself by marriage with the Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, Vayikach es bas Paro, and he married Pharaoh's daughter, Vayivieho el Ir David, and he brought her to the Ir David, to the Metsudas Sion, to the fortress of Zion, and he brought her there, and he built her a palace. And after becoming the son-in-law of Pharaoh and bringing his Egyptian wife to Yerushalayim, trade, and this is just the facts of Jewish history. Trade and cultural exchanges between Israel and Egypt flourished. Unfortunately, Shlomo HaMelech allowed his wife to continue her paganism and bring her idols with her to Jerusalem, which was really the beginning of the slippery slope. The fact was that even after Shlomo's death, none of the idols that Pharaoh's daughter set up in the hills around Jerusalem were removed for centuries. None of the kings. In fact, what's interesting about the book of Malachim is that when it describes the reign of a particular king, especially if it's a righteous king, it will tell you that this king did good. He was good in the eyes of God. He was a tzaddik. He was this, he was that, and the other. But he never removed the idols that Shlomo HaMelech's wife, the daughter of the king of Egypt, built in Jerusalem. It wasn't until you got right to the end, almost to the point where the Beis HaMikdash was going to be destroyed in the reign of King Yoshiyahu, the great King Yoshiyahu we've discussed before. He was hundreds of years later, 400 years later, or 350 years after Shlomo's death, he was the one that removed all the idols. They stayed there for hundreds and hundreds of years. So that by the time we come to the reign of King Ahaz, where public displays of idolatry were now acceptable, in fact, part of public policy, the infiltration into public Jewish life in Yerushalayim and Yehuda of Egyptian culture, of paganism and of perverted sexual practices had reached saturation point. Even though up to that point it was pretty much, you know, under the radar, it was the best kept secret in Yerushalayim. It was at this point that the Jews were not just indulging in the Egyptian pagan practices because it was something they enjoyed doing it, that they enjoyed doing. They were doing it like the Jews who built the original golden calf, as the Malbim again points out. The Jews were deliberately adopted more and more Egyptian culture, more and more Egyptian paganism into their lifestyle, that they even began to resemble the Egyptians. And they did this in order to anger God. As we know, getting back to this idea of appeasement, which again, you know, no one learns the lessons of history. They signed joint defense treaties with the Egyptians, which of course the Egyptians never honored. And basically, at this point in Jewish history, there was no difference between Egyptian culture and Jewish culture, between the lifestyle of the average Egyptian in the street and the lifestyle of the Jew in the street. The only difference was that the Jewish pagan, you know, he went to shul. You know, he went to shul and he put tefillin on in the morning. The Egyptian didn't. But everything else about their lifestyle was exactly the same. And it's something that Yeshayahu, the prophet Yeshayahu, complains about during Ahaz's reign. Listen to Yeshayahu describing, and again, Yeshayahu is speaking over 100 years before Yechezkel. He's complaining about exactly what God is complaining about here. And he's talking during Ahaz's reign, where again, it would appear that if you didn't know any better, you wouldn't know there was a difference between the lifestyle of the average Israelite and the lifestyle of the average Egyptian. He writes as follows. This is Yeshayahu in the 31st chapter of the book of Yeshayahu. Hoy hayordim Mitzrayim le'ezra. Woe to those who go to Egypt looking for aid. Ve'al susim yisha'enu. And who rely on their horses. Ve'yivtuchu al rechev. And who trust in their chariots. Ki rav, because they've got many. The Egyptians were famous for their horses and their chariots and their charioteers, but al proshim, the otzmu ma'od, the Jews, woe to the Jews who rely on the support and the defense treaty that relies on the Egyptian army with their chariots and their riders who are very strong, otzmu ma'od, they're very, very powerful. Below shaw al kadosh Yisrael, and they want nothing to do with the Kadosh Yisrael. They want nothing to do with God. That's, by the way, Yeshayahu, he's unique in his language. He's the only prophet that always describes God as the Kadosh Yisrael, the Holy One of Israel. No other prophet does that. That's how we know that all 66 chapters of Yeshayahu, despite the biblical critics and even some idiotic rabbis who think that Yeshayahu is written by two authors, it's absolutely clear from the language, the style of the writing, and certainly by the language of Kadosh Yisrael, that all 66 chapters were written by one author. Anyway, that's a different shit. But he says, "Velo shaw al Kadosh Yisrael, you preferred to rely on the Egyptians rather than God. Ves Hashem lo daroshu, you didn't even seek out God. You stopped davening. Vegam hu chochom, he too is wise. Vayavo ra." He too is wise, meaning God. God's not stupid. Vayavo ra, and he brought evil. Ve'estavorov lo hesir, and his words he will not retract. Ve'kam al beis mareim, and he will rise up over the house of the evildoers. Ve'al ezras po'al eoven, and upon the aid of workers of iniquity, those who aid the workers of iniquity. Umitzrayim Odom Velo El. Be aware, the Egyptians are men, they are not God. Vesusehem Boso Velo Ruach, and their horses are flesh, not spirit. Vahashem yati yodo, God will turn his hand on you, v'koshel ozer v'nofol ozer, and the helper will stumble, Egypt, and the helped one will fall, you, Jews, v'yachdov kulom yachliyun, and together the two of you, you and the Egyptians, will perish together. So that was the warning. That was the warning about getting too cozy with the Egyptians. From Yishayol, that was 100 years, well over 100 years before the destruction. So they cozied up. What's interesting, the catalyst, or the two catalysts for the close relationship between the Jews, the Jewish state, and the Egyptians, can be traced back to two incidents. The incident of the golden calf, and a little bit later on, the incident with Shlomo HaMelech bringing his pagan wife, his Egyptian princess, to Yerushalayim. And in fact, the Gemara in Moed Katan on Daf Tes discusses that Shlomo HaMelech built the Beit HaMikdash, as we know, and having built the Beit HaMikdash, so the Gemara says that they dedicated the first day of dedication was Yom Kippur. They had it on Yom Kippur, and they decided to dedicate the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, because if they dedicated the Beit HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, so they could cancel the fast, which is halachically appropriate. If you built a Beit HaMikdash and you have Mizmar Shir Chanukas Habayis LaDovid, if you dedicate a temple, a Beit HaMikdash, then it supersedes everything, even Yom Kippur. So Shlomo HaMelech planned it on Yom Kippur. And he also got married, Kol Nidre night, to this pagan woman, to the Pharaoh. Now, of course, that if you want more of the story, you can read it in the Gemara in Moed Katan on Daf Tes, page 9. Daf Tes on Madalaf, I think it's 27 lines down. I'm not sure my math is all that today. I'm starting to get old and forget stuff. But as far as I remember, it's 27 lines down on Daf Tes on Madalaf. His mother was not impressed. His mother being Bathsheba. But this is one of the catalysts for the downhill spiral. And of course, the Jews don't do anything by halves. So by the time it got to this stage in history, so again, Yeshayahu describes that he couldn't tell the difference. Couldn't tell the difference between a Jew and an Egyptian in terms of their behavior, in terms of the way they behaved. And it wasn't just, you know, the sex and drugs and rock and roll, the paganism, the adultery, and it was the corruption as well. As we've discussed on many occasions, the whole organizational structure of the Jewish state was corrupt. And as I mentioned, almost every time I discuss this period of Jewish history, if you think, you know, we're suffering now with corrupt governments, and you know, we are the Knesset is full of, you know, low lives, and this one and that one, and he did this, and they're all amateurs. All our current politicians and all our current leaders are all amateurs compared to this crowd. Achaz, King Menashe, all these guys, and the residents of Yerushalayim leading up to the time of the destruction of the first temple. The current crop of Jews in the land of Israel that you might consider have gone off the derech, or this one's corrupt, or this judge is no good, or the Iriah take bribes, or whatever. They're all rank amateurs compared to what we've produced in the past. You know, people, I'll say this as well, and for the record, you know, people, I hear people, a lot of them from the strictly Orthodox, the Orthodox community, you know, they harp on with rose-tinted glasses about the shtetl and, you know, how wonderful it was, you know, home on the range, and how wonderful it was, and how we loved the poverty, and how we loved the pogroms, at least we were from, and it was wonderful, the poverty was wonderful. I mean, this is just nonsense. You know, it's just nonsense. It's, you know, the expression, you've never had it so good. I don't know who was it, whose expression was that? Was that, I can't remember whose expression that was. You've never had it. I think it was a British Prime Minister. You know, Macmillan, I think it was. Macmillan. Prime Minister Harold Macmillan. He says, "You've never had it," or maybe it was the other, Harold Wilson. I don't know. One of the two, Macmillan or Wilson. "You've never had it so good. We've never had it so good here in the land of Israel. All the complaints set aside, notwithstanding the complaints. Everyone's got complaints in every generation. But the Jewish community in the Haim, the wonderful Haim in Lithuania, was a terrible place to be. The last place you'd want to have been born in, the last period of history you want to. And not only that, you think they were all from. They were in, the Jews of Odessa were drug runners, they were pimps, they were bookmakers, they were murderers, and they took it to America with them. Larry Lowenthal, do you remember Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel? What sort of a culture did they come from? They brought it with them from the Haim. So anyone that believes the nonsense of the, the shtetl and how wonderful it was, with the rose-tinted glasses of Jewish history, and a Lithuanian rabbi once said, not Lithuanian literally, but a Litvisher rabbi said to me, he said, "Maybe we should be back in the, we were better off in the Haim than we are in this country." I said, "You're off your rocker, man. You're absolutely off your rocker. We've never had it so good. This is the greatest moment in Jewish history. The greatest moment in Jewish history. Yeah, we're under pressure. Yeah, we've got enemies. We've always had enemies. We've always been under pressure. This is the greatest. There's more Torah being learned at this point in Jewish history than at any point in Jewish history before ever. To it in a multiple, in a multiple." And the Chofetz Chaim, going to be told, the Chofetz Chaim said, "This is the greatest generation, the greatest gen." He's talking about his generation. What does he say about ours? He says, "We're a greater generation than the generation that went out of Egypt. The generation that went out of Egypt saw miracles, as we'll discuss in the Seder night in 2 weeks' time. They saw 10 plagues, they saw the splitting of the Red Sea, they saw food coming down from heaven, they saw this, that, and the other, they saw everything. We're not seeing anything, but we're here. We sit, we learn, we believe, we're dedicated, we daven with kavanah. We're the greatest generation." And I'm not saying it's not my words, the words of the Chofetz Chaim, the Chazon Ish. "We're the greatest generation in Jewish history." So, however much we downplay ourselves and we criticize ourselves, that I see someone in the street, I hear people say, he's this, he's that, he's secular, he don't. So what? So what? He's a Jew. If he's a Jew and he's living in the land of Israel, he must have done something right. If God's put him here in the land of Israel at this period in history, I don't care if he eats pork bellies on Yom Kippur. There's something to be said for him. And if he hates Judaism, I don't care. If he's here, if God has placed, he's not in the audience. No one's in the audience. We're all actors here. We've all got a part to play, whoever we are. If God's put you here at this particular time, the greatest time in Jewish history, the greatest moment in Jewish history since the giving of the Torah on Mount Sinai, if you're here, so there's something to be said for you. And that should be the source of the greatest actors of the Jewish people. If Jewish people could just look at each other that way, wow, he's here, he's with us. He must be needed. He's got qualities. So anyway, that's me going off on a tangent. But you get the message. So this crowd, this Jewish crowd, the first thing that God's got to say about them, the first thing that God's got to say about them is that is to compare them to the Egyptians. And here we go. God's just getting started. That's the Egyptians. And here in verse 27, God moves on to public enemy number two, the perennial enemy of the Jewish people through history as well, even more so than the Egyptians, are the Pelishtim, the Philistines. V'hineh, verse 27, V'hineh notisi yodi olayich, that now behold, I stretched out my hand over you. V'aygra chukeich, and I diminished your maintenance. I mean, I diminished your food supply. V'aydnech b'nefesh nosayir, so nosayir. Benoz Pelishtim, and I delivered you under the will, the control of those who hate you, the daughters of the Philistines, Hanichlomos Midarkech Zimo, who were shocked by your vulgar ways. Now, if you, you're talking about pagans here, and for Brenta pagans, the Philistines, and they're shocked. They're shocked by the behavior of the Jews, right? So let's understand what's going on here. The Pasuk says, V'hinei notisi yodai alayich. God says, I tried to arrest the downward spiral of you people. So I stretched out my hand over you, meaning the tool that God regularly used throughout history to discipline the Jewish people for their wayward behavior was the raiders from the Gaza Strip. Does that mean anything to you? This has come from the Zohar, right? So I'm not making this up, right? The Zohar says the tool that God regularly used to discipline the Jewish people for their wayward behavior was the raiders from the Gaza Strip. That's what the Zohar says. Remember, the Palestinian were always temporary raiders, troublemakers, rather than long-term conquerors. The long-term conquerors were a last resort that God would only use much later, which was much later being the times of the Assyrians and later who would exile the 10 tribes and later on the Babylonians who would exile the southern kingdom as well. But the Pelishtim, the Philistines from the Gaza Strip, were God's like interim tool. When God wanted to express his disapproval of the Jewish people, He would use the Pelishtim, the Philistines. They would come in from the Gaza Strip, from their five towns, from Ashdod, Ashkelon, Ekron, Gath, and Gaza, and Aza. And he says, God says, Bo'egra chukeich, I diminished your maintenance, meaning, God says, I would regularly allow the Pelishtim to raid your towns and cities, occupy them for a limited period of time. And again, I'm not reading here from Ma'ariv from October 2023. I'm reading from the Zohar 2000 years ago. It says, I, God, would regularly allow the Palestinian, it's in Aramaic, but this is the correct translation. God says, I would regularly allow the Palestinian to raid your towns and cities and occupy them for a limited period of time, effectively cutting off both your food supply and threatening your assumption that you were totally secure in your own land. And of course, there are no shortage of examples. I'll just give you two, which point we'll finish, because this is quite frightening, this little interlude. Example number one is after the death of King Shaul, the first king of Israel, and his sons, including Yonatan, on Mount, in battle with the Philistines, the Pelishtim, on Mount Gilboa. We are told in Shmuel Aleph, in the first book of Shmuel, in chapter 31, right at the end, the last chapter of Shmuel Aleph, Vayiru Anshei Yisrael Asher Be'eva Ha'emek, and the men of Israel who are on the other side of the valley, Asher Be'eva HaYardein, and some of whom were on the other side of the Jordan River, Kinosu Anshei Yisrael. They saw that the Israeli army had fled, Bichimesu Shaul Vonov, and that Shaul and his three sons had been killed by Yazru Esa Orim Vayonusu, and that these Jews fled their cities. They left their cities and they fled by Yovol Pelishtim by Yeshu Bohem. And the Philistines came and occupied these towns. That's one example. Now, there are 20 examples. I'm only going to give you two. This one's much later, and it goes to the period of history that the Malbim says we're talking about here in these current verses, even as late as the reign of King Ahaz of Yehuda. The Philistines, the Pelishtim, continued to have great success in raiding Israelite cities and removing the Jewish inhabitants. And he says that here we see in Divrei Hayomim, in the book of Chronicles, the second book of Chronicles in chapter 28, U'pelishtim poshtu ba'orei ha'shvelon. And the Pelishtim raided the cities of the lowlands, Bahanegev Liyehuda, and the southlands of Yehuda. Vayilkadu es Beit Shemesh, and they captured Beit Shemesh for es Ayalon, and Ayalon for es Agderos, for es Shocho, Socho. They took the cities of Gederos and Socho, for es Timnah, and the villages of Timnah, Ubnosel, and its surrounding areas, its surrounding villages, the es Gimzel, the es Benosel, the Yeshushal. And they captured all these villages and they stayed there. They couldn't be removed. So this is one of the harsh realities. As quoted about the Zohar, the harsh realities of Jewish history, that this is the tool. Again, I'll repeat what the Zohar says. This is the tool, God's tool in reminding the Jewish people that they're not impregnable, that he's watching, and that you shouldn't feel totally secure in the land. That God, throughout biblical history, would allow the Pelishtim to raid their towns and their cities, to occupy them for a limited period of time, cutting off their food supply, and threatening their assumptions that they were totally secure in their own land. So these are just two examples. And, you know, in the Medrash here, in the Zohar, it mentions there's 20 examples of it. And then the verse continues, which is what we'll deal with next time. The next part of the verse, again, this is which verse are we on here? I get confused. Verse 27. This is the second enemy. We've dealt with the Egyptians. This is dealing with the Pelishtim. It says, "Vayet nech benefesh sonosayich benos Pelishtim." I delivered you under the control of those who hated you, the daughters of the Pelishtim. Exactly what it means. First of all, we know that the Pelishtim hated us. The Philistines hated us. They still do. And but what does it mean? I delivered you into the hands of those who hated you, the daughters of the Pelishtim. So we will have a discussion of that. In the middle, again, we're in the middle of verse 27, which is where we'll pick up. Please God, same time next week. I hope everybody enjoyed the shiur, wasn't too disturbed by the shiur, but it is what it is. This is the book of Yechezkel. This is a prophet, and the message of the Navi is a message for all time, all generations, and for everybody. So, again, I hope this part of the shiur wasn't the end part of the shiur wasn't too disturbing. But God is just in general terms, to sum up what's going on here now in these verses, God, so to speak, is analyzing our relationship with our neighbors and describing how we fell in line with the cultural norms and the cultural lifestyles and the pagan activities of our neighbors, and how we're going to suffer for it. So that's it for today. If anybody's got any questions, now's the time. If not, I'll say adieu and wish you a wonderful week. Shavua Tov. And once again, this shiur is dedicated. It should be a brocha. God should protect our soldiers. And we should be successful, as we say, biyachad nenatzeach. Only together, only as a b'leiv echad, can we be successful. There seems to be some cracks in that yichidus, in that achdus, at the moment. Let's hope those cracks are healed up pretty soon. On that note, I wish you all a wonderful week, a shavua tov, a gitavoch. And I'll see you same time, same place, for the next exciting installment of Yechezkel. Kol Tov to everybody. Have a great week. Have a great week.
Shalach.
Kol Tov.